Donald on the Kitchen talks about food. Donald on the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio.
The Donald on the Kitchen show is sponsored in part by the Mucky Duck Pub, where pub means community. More information can be found at www.themuckyduckpub.com or from Marcus at telephone number 232-8888.
Welcome to the Donna Lana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here once a week at the studios of KHOI Community Radio, and we talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. Yes, we do have opinions. And we thank you for joining us around our kitchen table today. Hello to fall. It just sort of fell on us in a big lump here, and we have to get ready for winter eventually here. It's the last hurrah, I think, for the tomatoes. Get out there and you can rip some off the vine. They're still good there, and they will ripen in the house if there's a little bit of blush on them yet. Here on the Donna Lana Kitchen, we talk about food, and that is a big topic, Donna, big topic. Do you think we've run out of things to talk about?
But no,
we don't.
Okay. There's always more.
Today, we will consider new trends in foods, future developments, foods of the future. My goodness. Joining us around our kitchen table today is Kate Gilbert.
Yes, Kate is a professor, assistant professor of teaching at ISU in the Food Science and Human Nutrition Department. So we called her up to ask her about novel proteins.
Welcome, Kate.
Hi, thanks for having me today.
So I have this quote I wanted to, I've been following this. This is a big growing trend in the food world, is all of these plant-based meat and dairy replacements, right? And we're not just talking soy milk here. There's a brave new world happening out here. So at the Alternative Protein Conference this year, here's a quote: "We'll see more change in the next 10 years than we've seen in the last 10,000. Also, the authors of a 2019 report predicted that the U.S. dairy and cattle industry would collapse by 2030 as the microscopic microbial protein factories came online. Well, I don't know about this. What do you think, Kate?
Well, as always, it's a bit more complicated than any sort of headline or single quote.
Okay, I'm not looking forward to completely eating
microbes.
Microbes, right.
Yes. So I think a lot of us are uncertain about that. I think there's a lot of work that has to be done with consumer education and explanations, but there's also a lot of research and technology that has to be developed around these microbes really to be a viable source.
So we're talking about food that is not food really as we know it, but food that is made in the laboratory of meats and protein. What exactly are we talking about, Kate?
Yes, let's back up and talk a little bit about protein first, because I think we often skip over this step. And until we understand protein and why protein is important in our diets, it's hard to really frame the entire conversation. So, and many of my food science students like to skip over this part too, but it's incredibly important to understand we need protein in our diets, especially for growth. So protein in kids, nutrition is extremely important, but protein is our structure function, right? We need proteins in our diet in order to keep our bodies moving, functioning, all those sorts of things. So when we talk about nutrition, it often, especially food insecurity, it comes down to calories and protein content. We can't just say calories in general. We know that we produce enough calories in the world for everybody. It doesn't get distributed correctly, but we don't produce enough protein in the world for everybody. And so this protein conversation is important then to think about how much protein do we need to feed everybody, keep everybody healthy. So that's kind of where we start. But then the next piece is about quality of protein. Digestibility is a big piece. So how much of the protein do you eat? Does your body actually use? So that's one thing to consider.
Does it vary by individual?
It does a little bit, but not as much maybe as some of your other digestion functions. There is some variation. How the protein has been cooked, how the food has been prepared affects digestibility. So that makes things a little bit more complicated. And then the amino acid profile. So there's 9 essential amino acids that we have to have because our body cannot manufacture. And so there are plenty of foods out there that are complete, have all of the essential amino acids that we need. And there's some that are incomplete. So we start off with the animal based. So our meat, milk, eggs are complete proteins. So they have all the amino acids that we need and they're highly digestible. So eggs are the standard. You get to use 100% of that protein you consume. Our bodies can use.
Eggs are the most perfect food, right?
In many different ways. And dairy is right up there too. Dairy protein is highly digestible, also complete. I have to say that. I come from the dairy farm, right? But high proteins. And then meat is pretty digestible as well. It's somewhere in the 90 to 95% you're going to be able to use. Plus, it's a complete protein. When we switch over to plant-based, we start to lose. We lose some of the digestibility. And we lose the amino acid profile that we need. It is possible to mix different plant sources to get the amino acids we need, but it gets more complicated. So cereals and legumes pair well together because the amino acids, essential like amino acids missing in cereals and legumes. Yeah, rice and beans, peanut butter sandwiches, that sort of thing. So it's possible to do, but it gets a little bit more complicated. So here in the United States, one of the last reports there from the 2015 to 2020 dietary guidelines say about 40% of us are not getting enough protein. And then 60% of us are getting...
In the U.S., 40%?
In the U.S., yes.
Whoa!
Often media just says we're all eating too much protein here in the United States, but we're finding out that it's striated. It's not that simple here in the United States.
Okay, so the people that are not getting... Is my guess that it's because of poverty, basically?
I think it's typically due to economic reasons. Why. And I sometimes older populations eat less protein because it just doesn't taste good to them anymore. You know, there might be some things like that. But most, I would say, is an economic reason. So the 40% that aren't getting enough protein in the United States, we definitely need to increase that for their health. The 60% that are at or above can definitely be eating less protein to share, right? But we know it's never quite that simple. Other places in the world where they're definitely not giving enough protein also has the disadvantage of typically consuming protein that's less digestible. So in many parts of the world, you know, grains that are being consumed like millet and sorghum, buckwheat have a pretty low digestibility of the protein due to some of the other compounds that are there. So they say that like 54 to 78% protein efficiency in much of the developing world. So that's a lot lower. So only do they not have enough protein, but their protein digestibility is fairly low. And so you need even more protein for them to be able to function. So you kind of need to know that piece. Otherwise, when we jump into other types of protein and doing this comparison, you just think grams of protein or protein production, but it's not the same across the board. And much of this new technology is going to cost quite a bit of money for a while. So it's not necessarily going to help those that need it most. It could maybe in the future, but we're definitely more than 10 years out and figuring that sort of production out.
Well, right. One of their big sales pitches for that, for the whole, you know, fake meat industry or whatever we're going to call it. Mm-hmm. And that's a whole nother question is what we're going to call it, is that it's going to make a lot of food cheaply, but that's only when it's scaled up tremendously. Right. Right. Yep, so we're not there yet.
No, we're definitely not there yet. So to know where we're going, it kind of helps to know what our protein sources are now and some of the concerns, because we're really thinking about environmental impact, we're thinking about cost, and we're thinking about nutrition. Mm-hmm. There's probably a few more in there, but those are kind of our main pieces. So our main meat, milk, egg production here in the United States is kind of the factory efficiency model, right? So a lot in one space, trying to be as efficient or quick as possible for inexpensive meat, milk, eggs. Mm-hmm. We know that that's not really the true cost of what people are paying in the grocery store, because we have
not
considered all of the environmental impacts, just in concentration of animals alone. We have not necessarily paid everybody a fair wage through that process. Animal welfare has improved, but there's still some room to go on there. The flip side, and often the piece that gets missed when we just want to kind of throw the baby out with the bathwater on meat production, is that there is also a smaller, holistic approach where you're considering environment, you're considering the animal, you're paying a fair wage through that process, and you're getting a high quality meat product, milk, eggs. We don't have enough of that to feed everybody. Obviously, there's the true cost, then it costs more to pay for those animal products because you've accounted for all of the pieces.
Well, and basically you're talking about having decentralizing animal proteins, like not having CAFOs. For example, your father, and this is why I wanted to have the discussion with you, because I know you're well grounded in good animal husbandry practices through your family's dairy farm, and your dad raises pigs for Nyman Ranch, which is all pastured pork. So these are models, smaller scale models, of better animal husbandry where the environmental costs are reduced, because, you know, I'm sure that in your family dairy farm, you probably still use a manure spreader, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a lot of composting for the parts of the year that the animals can do their own harvesting, right? The cows are out on pasture. The pigs are some too, especially the mother pigs. And so then you get some synergy, right? I mean, we're not perfect by any means, but if you are working synergistically together with the plants that you're growing, the crops that you're growing, and the livestock that you're growing, there are benefits there. And so, and just to say, like, we should get rid of all the animals. Whoa. This is a known ecosystem that can be used effectively. It's just that for most of our animal food production, in terms of quantity, right, that's not how things are being done.
But we could.
It could.
That is another solution for solving some of these greenhouse gas problems besides just factory manufacturing microbial proteins. There are other ways to approach this situation.
Yes. So there are definitely, you know, we often have to work with the system that is in place and not just throw it out. I mean, there's a variety of systems I think we would like to get rid of right now in the United States, but it's hard to get rid of a complete system. It's better to work in the system and make improvements on. We often just jump then to plant-based proteins, and they have this like halo, like they're perfect. We go, time out. How do we know how these crops are being raised, right, and grown? If these crops are being grown with good practices for the environment,
low tillage. Now, you're talking about the ones that are soy-based, basically.
Yeah, soy, peas, you know, even some of our grains that have decent protein that you can match. You know, if low tillage is happening, if cover crops are being used, if you are paying attention to soil health, building organic matter, great, right? Then these plant-based proteins probably have some advantages over that kind of factory efficiency model of meat. But if you are not taking care of the soil and the land and your water usage, then I would say you're not really creating that much of an advantage going to plant.
No, you're having the same problems that you have in conventional meat and dairy production. I mean,
yeah.
So that's now, but there are other kinds of, what are we calling them? Novel proteins. Yes. Some of the more things that are not based even on soy, or like there's one where they're using air as their feedstock. They're using what is it, the carbon or the nitrogen?
I think they're using carbon dioxide as part of their energy source. Yeah, so I want to make one more point kind of before we jump into our alternative proteins. And this might be my soapbox thing that I just need to get out there.
Go for it.
But often when we use plant-based proteins to produce something that resembles meat, milk, any of our animal-based products, we do it terribly. We do not pull through the same nutrition that you're going to get in animal products at all. Or you're definitely not making an improvement, which is often what people think. But we can watch that with all of the alternative milks. Soy milk is your exception. High protein, pretty digestible, pretty similar to milk. But your almond
milk. But processed.
Yeah, yeah. All your other milks have so little protein, so many more ingredients. These are not equivalent, and we are confusing consumers about this. And these new plant-based meat alternatives that look like meat, act like meat, you know, that's the big selling point. They're interesting and I think very novel, but they have the same amount of fat and saturated fat and salt, if not more than regular meat products. So they have this like healthy halo that is not true at all.
So we're finding a lot of these things that are not meat, not dairy on grocery shelves already. I can't believe it's a burger. It's not a burger. Don't even think this is a burger.
Right, the kind impossible of burger. And, the oat milk.
Just the fact that you eat it and you don't get the nutrition. Are people having physical reactions to this? I mean, we didn't always grow up to be eating some of this stuff.
That is a really good thing that I don't think we know enough about yet. And the other thing is that if you read ingredient decks, in order to be able to make something that looks like meat that is not meat, it takes a lot of ingredients to be able to do. And so when you read some of those labels, you go, whoa. So if we are not used to consuming all those things together, then we have some concerns about possibly digestibility. But probably the big one, and the big one that we talk about proteins, is when it comes to allergic reactions, they're almost always protein-based.
Ah.
So when we go thinking about different proteins, we know the major 8 proteins that usually cause allergies, but it doesn't mean that a smaller percent of a population might have an allergic reaction to a new or novel protein. So there has to be a lot of testing in place. I'm assuming many of these new meat alternatives have done much of their testing, but we know Impossible Burger took forever to get approved because of some of their novel proteins that they were being used. And so it got held up through the FDA for years before it finally got approved. So there are definitely some questions and a fair bit of testing that needs to be done depending on the ingredients being used in these.
Could you help me think about for years, vegetarians or if you wanted a break from meat, you could have a hamburger-like object made out of beans and grains and things. This seems to be another step because they're calling it almost meat, but not quite. It's not just a veggie burger. It's not just a bean burger. What's the difference?
So I think that's a really important thing to think about. And actually, one of my colleagues pointed this out to me last spring. We had a meeting for food science professionals, and we did a lot of tasting of these new products, thought through a little bit of the history. But when I was trying to decide what to serve, he goes, who is your target? And of course, I was thinking about my audience that was showing up to that meeting, but not in terms of, are you a meat eater that just wants to eat less meat? Or are you a vegan or vegetarian who is not really interested in meat anymore? And your vegans and vegetarians want nothing to do with something that bleeds, right? Even if it's plant-based, they are not interested. So this new line of meat products is for meat eaters who wants to give themselves a gold star, I think. The vegans and the vegetarians want your traditional or your black bean burger, you know, something that is not meat-like. Because that is not their interest. So we've kind of divided our lines now of who we're targeting. Your older kind of veggie burger is more your traditional for vegans and vegetarians. This newer product is targeting a new audience.
Well, they're also we've talked about meat, but for example, recently they've brought, I think it's on market or very close to market, an alternative made human breast milk like substance, really? For example. I don't know how I feel about that. Of course, you know, babies that have to be fed formula often have a lot of problems because it's not, you know, it's not as digestible as breast milk. But so what about making human breast milk? How are they doing that?
Yeah. Okay. So let's jump in to some of our alternative protein sources here.
Oh yeah. They're not, there's different kinds too. So yes. This is what we need to tell us.
So we know one of the solutions of getting enough protein for everybody is for us that are eating enough protein to consume a little less, right? Probably eat some of the plant-based proteins, but not, you know, make them yourself, right? Not let get the meal.
Yeah, boil up a pot of beans and have some rice with it.
Yeah, but that's not, it's not going to sell anything in the grocery store with a high margin of profit, right? And it's not a jazzy solution. Meatless Mondays maybe carried on, but that's about as far as we've gotten with just the, this makes sense, let's do this sort of approach. Obviously getting protein sources to other places in the world is probably local solutions, possibly more chickens, better fish, you know, that sort of thing. But then we jump into, okay, what can technology do for us? And that's where we're starting with the breast milk or casein production. And so this is basically putting microbes in a tank with some sort of food source and saying, produce protein. magic, right? This is where it gets hard to explain to the consumers and where you start to worry about some consumer acceptance. And one of those articles did a good job of trying to put it in consumer-friendly terms, starting off with thinking about fermentation. And we like fermentation, right? They're a bunch of great...
That's a familiar word, right?
Yes. And we love fermented foods, right? I mean, fermentation was mostly done for longer shelf life, or, you know, so your food would last longer when it's spoiled.
It's a technology that we are accustomed to in terms of evolutionary biology.
Yes. And we love it. We love beer. We love bread. We love sauerkraut. We love soy sauce. You know, I mean, we love many of these fermented things.
So, yogurt.
Yes. Great stuff. And sometimes fermentation helps with protein availability. That's actually one of the solutions for many of the grains in developing world is that fermentation will increase protein availability that's already there, so you digest more of it. So mm-hmm. on that first level, we're all happy, right? Fermentation, check. We understand it fairly well. We probably can't draw out all of the structures of what's happening, but it's a pretty accepted practice.
Well, except it's not really, it's not your grandmother's fermentation.
Right. So then it starts to get more complicated, right? They sort of lead you in with like, let's just talk about fermentation. It's happy. We're all happy here. And then it gets more complicated. The next level is essentially producing protein, yeast, or algae because they're fairly high in protein naturally. And you're like, okay, all right. You know, there's probiotics in yogurt.
I know what algae is, but what are we talking about when we say protein yeast?
Yeast and bacteria, depending on the strains, will produce some protein naturally. And so they're looking at different versions of these microbes that would produce fairly high protein. Algae is really where we're seeing a lot of that working, but mm-hmm. the corn product that's out on the market now has been for a few years. They call that a mycoprotein.
The QURN, that product line, right. Okay. That's widely available, right.
And so they call that a soil microbe, and that's their protein source. I don't think they're harvesting it from the soil and putting it in the burger, right? But they've extracted it and are growing it. So I don't know that they know all of the sources to be able to do that. But essentially, they're feeding microbes, then they're drying them down, maybe a heat process, I'm not quite sure, making a powder often. And that's where your protein source is coming from. So that's kind of middle level acceptable, right?
Yeah,
probably... Go ahead.
I'm going to jump in here and let us digest what you've been saying here for a bit. And we're going to take a little break. And I want to remind you, you're listening to KHOI Community Radio. This is Donalana Kitchen Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Kitchen. Welcome back to our kitchen table. We're talking to Kate Gilbert about alternative proteins because things just aren't your grandfather's hamburger anymore. No, people are experimenting with all different kinds of ways to get the kind of foods we need. There are many, many, many reasons for it. And Kate Gilbert has been talking about alternative protein sources. We were talking about algae and making things out of not meat, but they try real hard to make it taste like meat. You want to talk about that?
Yes, I've thrown a lot at you and set a lot of a stage there to try to see where we're at. Because otherwise, if you start talking about making meat from non-meat or starting to raise microbes in a tank, it seems very confusing on how we got there, right? But knowing that we need more protein than what we're currently producing, we need to fix some of the systems to make them more efficient in terms of thinking of all the pieces holistically. We still are probably going to need some more protein. So here we are with our not as healthy as we think meat-based, you know, plant-based meat alternatives. And now we're putting stuff in tanks to produce protein.
Yeah, and what is that stuff?
Yeah. So the process and from all the articles we're reading and the technology that we're trying to kind of piece together on what's happening is that we have tanks with some sort of food source in it and microbes that are going to produce protein. And then they will dry
you
down
mean
the
a
protein
food source for the microbes. Not
yep. Meat. Yep. Yeah. So, and often that's a carbohydrate, but we know with protein production, there has to be a nitrogen source somewhere along the way. The best articles that things that we've read are using waste product or CO2 from the air to do that. But otherwise, we have to ask ourselves, like, is it a grain that we're not raising very well? You know, or like, what's our impact of that incoming source? Waste products.
Well, like when you say they're making out of algae, where are they getting the algae?
So they, I'm assuming, we'd have to double check, but they have looked for the algae strains that produce protein, probably, they all produce some protein, but produce higher levels of protein, and that will work in a tank-based system. So there's the chlorella and there's the spirulina, are the ones that we see most often in the grocery store. So they are extracting from whatever source that they those were originally found, and then they're propagating or growing more of them in these tanks so that they eat the food, produce more, and at a certain point in time when all the production has happened in the tank that they're going to get, then they're going to extract the algae, dry it down, and mostly make a powder. Right now there's kind of a...
At that point, then the algae are still at least they're still coming from a natural source.
Yep. Yeah. So I think in terms of consumer acceptance, it's a little confusing, but we're okay explaining that, or we haven't gotten the complicated level here yet. So I see that starting to enter the market and some consumer acceptance. I mean, corn is obviously well established. Algae, we think, is novel right now, so we're giving it a try. Both of those are fairly highly digestible, so that's an advantage on one of those things that we're looking for nutrition. Where it gets really complicated is that synthetic biology level, and that's where a lot of the money is going.
Tell us, this is where I'm very anxious.
Yes, and I must say I'm not an expert. I understand a little bit of the process, but I think there's a lot of pieces to still understand.
Well, we called you because we knew that you understood more than Lon and I, so give it a go.
So, and you can definitely go down a rabbit hole reading a lot of articles. So if anybody's interested, you can kind of start digging into this more. But they are taking microbes, and they're trying to figure out right now what the best bacteria or yeast host is. They often use a lot of E. coli. Sometimes they use yeast. I think they're doing a lot of research trying to figure this out. They have extracted the protein or the DNA sequence needed to produce a protein. And DNA sequencing has gotten a lot less expensive. It's gotten more efficient. So it's more possible to do now than it would have been previously. So they pick out the DNA sequence to make casein or to produce some of the proteins in.
So did they go into a natural form of casein and just pull out the DNA that they think is appropriate? I mean...
You would need the cells that produce the casein. And I don't know exactly their extraction method to figure that out, but they take cells that produce milk, essentially take the DNA. I would think that information would be in all the cells, of the dairy cow, right? But you extract mm-hmm. cells, you sequence the DNA, you find the chunk or the tiny piece of the DNA that is going to code to produce the casein, or in some instances, egg protein, whatever the case may be. But obviously with dairy cows, you're going to go get the casein. You need chicken cells to get the egg DNA. You take that specific piece, you turn it into a plasmid, which is how viruses share DNA. And then you have these viruses that will take that specific piece of DNA that's going to make a specific protein, and they're going to put it in whatever the host is. So a bacteria or a yeast. So now you've added the DNA sequence that you need to produce a protein into your desired host.
Yuck. Well, sorry. And this is how you milk. That's milk that's not made from cows, for example, or breast milk.
Yes. Yes.
And that's assuming nobody made any mistakes along the way, right? And that we really understand what we're doing. Oh, right. Dear.
I do think they've gotten better at doing this. You all get a little squeamish when we talk about viruses and moving DNA. I mean, obviously, we're in the middle of a pandemic right now, worrying about viruses and moving, you know, DNA pieces. But specifically, you can use this technology for good, and you can use this technology for not so good.
That's assuming that we really know what we're doing. I'm not willing to make that leap personally.
But Donna, they probably have a recipe.
Well, let's
just talk about recipes, right?
Suspend your disbelief, because that's fair. This whole process needs regulations in place. It needs a lot more testing. There's a bunch of things that
need there's a lot of ethical questions involved also.
Yes. So, all right, now we have gotten the microbe that we need that's going to produce a specific protein. I know you've already gotten lost here, but it gets still a little more complicated.
Oh, there's more. Oh, dear.
There's more. So then you're going to have to raise more of these microbes, right? So they're going to produce that specific protein. So back into the tanks we go with whatever food source that those microbes need. We have to give them a bit of time to grow. It happens fairly quickly, depending on what the source is. But now we've got a bunch of microbes. It could be bacteria, it could be yeast, whatever you decide is your host microorganism that's produced that protein for you, but it's inside the cell.
Oh.
So, you know, it's not just like magically like the casein's going to float to the top and the microbes float to the bottom. Right? It's
okay. So more processing. Okay.
Yes.
And so get the stuff out then.
Yeah, and so
it depends. They don't just smash it, right?
Say that again.
They don't just smash it and strain it.
No. Okay. There probably is a step where they're breaking open the cells, and I'm not certain on how exactly that's working. But
does that take enzymes or something?
It could be enzymes. There's ways to kind of lyse open or break open cell walls, so I'm assuming it's something like that. It could be some like centrifuging or something where you've got some force that might open things up.
Mm-hmm.
It may depend on the microbe.
Smashing. They're smashing.
Yep. Okay. So they're probably smashing, but in more technical terms.
Okay. They're smashing and straining, right?
Yeah. Whatever the protein is, then you have to be able to extract from the other proteins that the microbe has produced.
That's the thing that you want. And then you got something left over too that you have to do something with, right?
Right. And no one is exactly talking about that whole process. They're just alluding to that they need more efficiency.
Okay. I can see why they're not talking about it, right?
And that's because, and that's one of the things that they bring up. We are using nature to get what we want. And whenever we're using something live organism, you can't tell them, I want 100% casein, don't do anything else, right? That microbe still has its regular DNA that's going to produce the things it needs for the cell to replicate. And so at some point in time, it says, all right, I'll do what you want. I'll produce some casein, but I got to do other stuff, right? And so they're trying to manipulate those microbes to produce even more, to work in conditions that maybe we'll use more waste product for food, and then trying to figure out an easier way for extraction. And they need that. They need to increase their yield and make this more scalable to get to that affordable, easy-to-use protein that we are looking for. So one of their ideas is to actually get the enzyme out of those microbes. So that's a couple extra steps, but down the road, just get the enzyme you need, just provide the food stuff for that enzyme and produce the protein, because now you're not working in a cellular system. You don't have to get rid of all the cells when you're done. You're just using enzymes.
Smash and strain then, right?
They're trying to get rid of the smash and strain. Yes, exactly.
Oh boy.
And so until that gets figured out, I don't think anybody is going to say what their yield is, what the cost will be. They're all saying hypothetically this is possible, which is how all new technology starts. Hypothetically, this is possible.
The phrase from this paper is that cultured animal cells and microbes and the world leading, that they are more efficient and sustainable ways to feed people. Doesn't sound like it to me.
Yeah. I mean, you don't have to wait the amount of time that it takes to grow an animal before you harvest it. So maybe there is some environmental benefit there, but we need to know more, right? I think they are banking on a higher yield, making this easily scalable in order to make those claims. I could see them definitely making the claims if they can figure out how to use waste streams for food for the microbes. But if they're not, I mean, you can't make something out of nothing, right? You're gonna have to think about.
Yeah. That's an old rule that we haven't, it's still in effect as far as I hear.
Right. And so the venture capitalists and all the money that is getting thrown on this,
and there's a lot.
And there's a lot. is probably not all philanthropic, right? You know, it's probably not all to get enough protein to everybody in the world. But they are going after that hypothetical.
Yeah, it's the latest get rich quick scheme, I'm afraid.
Yeah. And so it's going to take some time. So I do think that there's going to be obviously a bunch of money going into this technology to figure out, a bunch of work to figure out if they can get things to be more efficient and scalable. But then we are still going to have some hurdles. This is brand new, so there's not regulation in place. And that's one of the things that a previous conference brought up. Like, we need regulations, and preferably regulations that everybody agrees on throughout.
Okay, so the USDA and the FDA don't have enough rules to cover this kind of stuff. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, right. Right. And that's because this is fairly new and awfully new going into the food system. There's a few exceptions to that. We have used some microbes to produce some food components. And I'm not positive exactly on if that was completely synthetic biology. We have definitely been using microbes and kind of souping up microbes to get some of the things we need in the food system. But this takes it to another level, really, from my understanding. And somebody who maybe has been tracking this in more detail than I am would argue that. But what we are opening up with all this money right now and all the different things we're looking at, I think brings the level of, yeah, we need a little bit more regulation in place there. Uh-huh. But it appears it's just still working under the GRAS system, the generally recognized as safe.
Yeah, right.
You create a new microbe or compound in a different way, prove it safe, turn it in the FDA, FDA stamps it and turns it back.
Right, because some of this stuff is on the market already.
Yeah. And so the one of those examples was what I mentioned earlier, the heme group, or what makes it look like it's bloody in the Impossible Burger. The
Impossible Burger, right.
Yes. And that's why it was only in restaurants for quite a while and took a while to get into the grocery store. It got caught through that FDA approval process, and it's because there were some groups that contested. But it's a soy heme compound that's being produced by yeast. And so this is definitely in that synthetic biology category where they've taken what they need from the DNA from the soy, put it in the yeast for the yeast to produce this compound. And there were a lot of questions on, you can't just say that people have consumed this soy product. You have to say, have they also consumed this yeast product? Because you can't completely separate the two. So that you needed to do safety testing and consumption for those two things together and not just the soy compound.
So but they did it.
Yeah.
They got it through the testing process, and it's on the market.
Yep.
We're going to take a little break here. We are talking about the brave new world here, about the stuff we are eating and will be eating. This is KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is KHOI Community Radio. If you want to find more about this radio station and the Donna Lana Kitchen, go to khoifm.org. Lots more at that website. We're on the air 24/7. Lots of good things going on.
We got about 5 more minutes, Kate.
Okay.
We are back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking about the brave new world of alternative protein with Kate Gilbert. So you've told us a lot about what's been cooking in labs, and it must be a trendy thing to do. Big companies are investing in this stuff, but will we bite? I have a quote here. It says, most people do not eat meat because animals were slaughtered. They eat it in spite of that fact. We have been eating meat because we need the protein. And so now here are some alternative sources. So if it tastes good, if it's good nutrition, will we eat it? I think the companies are betting on that. Will we eat this stuff, Kate?
That's a fantastic question. I think a lot of us are not going to jump on that wagon for quite some time. More information needs to be found out. I think a lot more research needs to be done. But we have a hard time explaining to consumers how food is made in general, right? Where it comes from, how it's processed. And it took me a while to explain it to you guys who had done some research, right? It's not an easy thing to explain. So you might get some consumer acceptance who just decides like, oh, fermentation sounds fun. Check her off the list. But I think a lot of people are going to go, whoa, right? We need to explain more about this. Or, hey, the eating quality of this is not as good as my meat, milk, and eggs, and I'm not giving them up, right? Just so you know, just because you can produce casein and extract it does not mean your cheese is going to taste exactly the same. A lot of your flavor components of cheese come from the other components as well. And so to sign off right away and be like, yep, check, I'm happy just to trade out proteins, I think is going to take some time.
Well, this is my main question is in terms of, you know, the proteins that we have been eating from milk, dairy, meat, you know, even beans and rice are things that human beings have been eating for thousands of years. And our digestive systems have evolved to eat these kinds of proteins. Now, even though they're saying it might look similar, it might feel similar, is it in fact really similar? Are we really going to be able to change the human diet from what we've been eating for 10,000 years? This is like, I'm not sure this is possible.
It seems, and this is back where we're to the theory, right? Theoretically, right. It could be possible, but we need to find out more. We need to compare the casein molecule that's being produced by these microbes or some of the egg protein molecules or, you know, any of those things and make sure they are really identical enough that some of our digestive systems aren't going to kind of mark that as an allergen.
Right. Like identical enough. Okay. That means, of course, they're not identical exactly.
Yeah. I'm not positive. In theory, right, if you're using the DNA sequence that produces casein and it goes perfectly into the microbe and it follows the instructions perfectly, you should get the same compound. But I, you know, until that's shown, and I still think you'll need feeding studies, safe ones, right?
Yeah, I'm going to let somebody else eat a lot of it first. It's not going to be me, right?
Yeah, that's how we associate risk, right? We want somebody else to go through all of those steps. Yeah. And the other thing is we see synthetic biology being used for medicine, and we are much more likely to use that as a cancer treatment where we are looking for anything and everything, right? To be able to solve those.
Where there's already danger and terrible consequences involved, then you're more willing to take a risk because.
Right. We want them to lead the way and then maybe come over the food and do the same testing and maybe we'll jump. But, you know, our risk level and what we consider necessary is lower on the food end.
Well, when we get to the medical stuff too, do you want to talk about kind of ethical guidelines that are needed for this sort of?
I think that's a whole can of worms when it comes to ethics and risk. Obviously on the medical side, they're starting to talk about, you know, we can pick out genes that are going to cause disease and should we go into humans and adjust those genes? And you go, oh, whoa, time out. This gets far more complicated. So at least on the food end, we have less ethics concerns, but it gets really complicated on what should or shouldn't be used or done with synthetic biology.
Okay, well, in the world that you're in professionally, do you see people starting to have ethics discussions?
Not yet. And it's probably happening, but we wait and see, you know, is something really going to work before we jump into all the details. And with this cellular protein production, we're still sort of on the edge going, that looks interesting, but tell us when it really works, right? Before we jump in to have all the discussion. And it maybe should be opposite, right? But we've watched in the food industry a lot of things that don't work. You know, that they sounded like a really great idea, but you just couldn't get the efficiency, the yield, the things you needed in place, or consumer acceptance. I mean, it's still possible. Consumer acceptance could be a problem. So we haven't delved completely in. We're still on the edge going, that looks interesting. Tell us more.
That's right. But we are complicated creatures anyway, and feeding us has been a centuries and decades and millennial idea of how we can sustain ourselves. This is kind of a interesting blip, and I'm sure we can learn many things from alternative protein. That, well, we need proteins. That's good. Do you eat anything that you pull off the shelf that is an alternative protein yourself?
No.
There you go. Okay. Yeah.
Well, I've checked them out because I wanted to know as a educated food scientist, right. But you know, I would rather pay or put my money towards well-raised meat, poultry, milk. I'm happy about legumes and grains that I'm cooking myself, but I don't, not interested in the extra, because I think we can still make improvements on the systems that are currently in place.
There you go.
That's true. There's an amazing laboratory out there that we call the Earth. And I think making that work right might be to our advantage.
Yeah, well, there's the old nature bats last, so we should be respectful.
Yep. I mean, definitely all the options should be on the table so that we can feed everybody safely. But yeah, working with our current systems and paying attention to nature, I think is a good focus while we learn a lot more about this new technology before we sign on for it.
Excellent. Very level-headed, Kate. Thank you so much.
Thanks for being with us today. Yeah. And if we have any questions about stuff that's on the shelf, I'm going to give you a call because there are some interesting things.
Yeah,
out there.
Reading labels has gotten very complicated these days. So
I'm happy to help.
Thank you, Kate. Thank you. We've been talking to Kate Gilbert, and she's told us a lot about what this brave new world of food is like.
Yeah, she's in the ISU Department of Food Service and Food Science and Human Nutrition. So they're keeping watch on this stuff for us.
Speaking of foods, of human nutrition here, I'm going to let Donna talk about biscotti for a little bit, because if you go to the KHOI website, there is an online auction now. We need your support, and buying something on this auction would be a good idea. KHOIFM.org. You can go to the KHOI auction house button, push that button, and on that site, you will find some biscotti. Tell us about
the biscotti. Lon and I decided for our contribution to the online auction, I would make some biscotti with my famous Michelle Pfeiffer biscotti recipe. Now, it's whole grains. I use organic wheat grown in Iowa from early morning harvest. I use chicken eggs from Lana's chicken coop. And the reason they're called the Michelle Pfeiffer biscotti is because when I used to cook for her, she wanted me to devise a recipe where she would have a convenient, healthy dessert that had no fat in it. So these biscotti have no fat in them. So they're relatively healthy, and they're whole grains and fruits and nuts. And if you want to try them, you can bid on them on the KHOI auction.
Yes, go to the KHOI auction house at www.khoifm.org. Support this fine radio station. Yes. Also, I want to mention some other upcomings. We kind of check in with the Practical Farmers of Iowa organization every now and then, and they have field days. And this year, because of the pandemic, of course, we don't have face-to-face field days, but they have done a bang-up job with virtual field days. And there are a couple left on Facebook, and you can meet your farmers up close and join in the conversation, or just sit back and listen and watch. There's one coming up on Wednesday, October 7th at the Red Fern Farm, talking about harvesting fruit and nut crops. Learn about chestnuts.
Yeah, they do chestnuts and persimmons.
And pawpaws.
Two of my favorites.
Persimmons. So just find out about the not so common fruits and nuts. You can find out more about these, that field day, and much more stuff at practicalfarmers.org. They're still going strong. There are still farmers growing out there, growing things like with the sun, the energy of the sun, and seeds and dirt.
Soil. Yeah, and another thing that we want to tell you, encourage you to do while the weather is nice, is to get out to Berry Patch and pick your own apples. It's a you pick. They also have pumpkins. They are open. It's east of Ames, between Ames and Nevada, the Berry Patch Farm, a beautiful place to go and pick your own apples. They are open Tuesday and Thursday, 9 to 6, and Saturday, 9 to 1:30. Go have at it. It is a seasonal opportunity.
You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. Thanks for joining us today. We had music today by the band Nightingale. Support Community Radio. My name is Lana Noctica.
And I'm Donna Friskintus.
And we've had excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.